Chapter 85. Up to your chin and your arms clasped around them, but you are bound to turn over presently, because you are top-heavy in that position. You can stand up straight in water that is over your head, and from the middle of your breast upward you will not be wet. But you cannot remain so. The water will soon float your feet to the surface. You cannot swim on your back, and make any progress of any consequence, because your feet stick away above the surface, and there is nothing to propel yourself with but your heels. If you swim on your face, you kick up the water like a stern wheel boat. You make no headway. A horse is so top-heavy that he can neither swim nor stand up in the Dead Sea. He turns over on his side at once. Some of us bathed for more than an hour, and then came out coated with salt till we shone like icicles. We scrubbed it off with a coarse towel and rode off with a splendid brand new smell, though it was one which was not any more disagreeable than those we have been for several weeks enjoying. It was the variegated villainy and novelty of it that charmed us. Salt crystals glitter in the sun about the shores of the lake. In places they coat the ground like a brilliant crust of ice. When I was a boy I somehow got the impression that the River Jordan was 4,000 miles long and 35 miles wide. It is only 90 miles long, and so crooked, that a man does not know which side of it he is on half the time. In going 90 miles it does not get over more than 50 miles of ground. It is not any wider than Broadway in New York. There is the Sea of Galilee, and this Dead Sea, neither of them 20 miles long or 13 wide. And yet when I was in Sunday school I thought they were 60,000 miles in diameter. Travel and experience mar the grandest pictures, and rob us of the most cherished traditions of our boyhood. Well, let them go. I have already seen the empire of King Solomon diminish to the size of the state of Pennsylvania. I suppose I can bear the reduction of the seas and the river. We looked everywhere, as we passed along, but never saw grain or crystal of Lot's wife. It was a great disappointment. For many and many a year we had known her sad story, and taken that interest in her which misfortune always inspires. But she was gone. Her picturesque form no longer looms above the desert of the Dead Sea, to remind the tourist of the doom that fell upon the lost cities. I cannot describe the hideous afternoon's ride from the Dead Sea to Mars Saba. It oppresses me yet, to think of it. The sun so pelted us, that the tears ran down our cheeks once or twice. The ghastly treeless, grassless, breathless cannon smothered us, as if we had been in an oven. The sun had positive weight to it, I think. Not a man could sit erect under it. All drooped low in the saddles. John preached in this wilderness. It must have been exhausting work. What a very heaven the messy towers and ramparts of vast Mars Saba looked to us when we caught a first glimpse of them. We stayed at this great convent all night, guests of the hospitable priests. Mars Saba, perched upon a crag, a human nest stock high up against a perpendicular mountain wall, is a world of grand masonry that rises, terrace upon terrace away above your head, like the terraced and retreating colonnades one sees in fanciful pictures of Belshazzar's feast, and the palaces of the ancient pharaohs. No other human dwelling is near. It was founded many ages ago by a holy recluse who lived at first in a cave in the rock, a cave which is enclosed in the convent walls now, and was reverently shown to us by the priests. This recluse, by his rigorous torturing of his flesh, his diet of bread and water, his utter withdrawal from all society, and from the vanities of the world, and his constant prayer and saintly contemplation of a skull, inspired an emulation that brought about many disciples. The precipice on the opposite side of the canyon is well perforated with the small holes they dug in the rock to live in. The present occupants of Mars Saba, about 70 in number, are all hermits. They wear a coarse robe, an ugly brimless stovepipe of a hat, and go without shoes. They eat nothing whatever but bread and salt. They drink nothing but water. As long as they live they can never go outside the walls, or look upon a woman, for no woman is permitted to enter Mars Saba, upon any pretext whatsoever. Some of those men have been shut up there for 30 years. In all that dreary time they have not heard the laughter of a child, or the blessed voice of a woman. They have seen no human tears, no human smiles. They have known no human joys, no wholesome human sorrows. In their hearts are no memories of the past, in their brains no dreams of the future. All that is lovable, beautiful, worthy, they have put far away from them. Against all things that are pleasant to look upon, and all sounds that are music to the ear, they have barred their massive doors, and reared their relentless walls of stone forever. They have banished the tender grace of life, and left only the sapped and skinny mockery. Their lips are lips that never kiss and never sing. Their hearts are hearts that never hate and never love. Their breasts are breasts that never swell with the sentiment, I have a country and a flag. They are dead men who walk. I set down these first thoughts because they are natural, not because they are just, or because it is right to set them down. It is easy for bookmakers to say, thought so and so as I looked upon such and such a scene, when the truth is, they thought all those fine things afterwards. One's first thought is not likely to be strictly accurate, yet it is no crime to think it, and none to write it down, subject to modification by later experience. These hermits are dead men, in several respects, but not in all, and it is not proper that, thinking ill of them at first, I should go on doing so, or, speaking ill of them, I should reiterate the words and stick to them. No, they treated us too kindly for that. There is something human about them somewhere. They knew we were foreigners and Protestants, and not likely to feel admiration or much friendliness toward them. But their large charity was above considering such things. They simply saw in us men who were hungry, and thirsty, and tired, and that was sufficient. They opened their doors, and gave us welcome. They asked no questions, and they made no self-righteous display of their hospitality. They fished for no compliments. They moved quietly about, setting the table for us, making the beds, and bringing water to wash in, and paid no heed when we said it was wrong for them to do that, when we had men whose business it was to perform such offices. We fared most comfortably, and sat late at dinner. We walked all over the building with the hermits afterward, and then sat on the lofty battlements and smoked, while we enjoyed the cool air, the wild scenery and the sunset. One or two chose cozy bedrooms to sleep in, but the nomadic instinct prompted the rest to sleep on the broad divan that extended around the great hall, because it seemed like sleeping out of doors, and so was more cheery and inviting. It was a royal rest we had. When we got up to breakfast in the morning, we were new men. For all this hospitality, no strict charge was made. We could give something if we chose. We need give nothing if we were poor or if we were stingy. The pauper and the miser are as free as any in the Catholic convents of Palestine. I have been educated to enmity toward everything that is Catholic, and sometimes, in consequence of this, I find it much easier to discover Catholic faults than Catholic merits. But there is one thing I feel no disposition to overlook, and no disposition to forget, and that is the honest gratitude I and all pilgrims owe to the convent fathers in Palestine. Their doors are always open, and there is always a welcome for any worthy man who comes, whether he comes in rags or clad in purple. The Catholic convents are a priceless blessing to the poor. A pilgrim without money, whether he be a Protestant or a Catholic, can travel the length and breadth of Palestine, and in the midst of her desert wastes find wholesome food and a clean bed every night in these buildings. Pilgrims in better circumstances are often stricken down by the sun and the fevers of the country, and then their saving refuge is the convent. Without these hospitable retreats, travel in Palestine would be a pleasure which none but the strongest men could dare to undertake. Our party, pilgrims and all, will always be ready and always willing to touch glasses and drink health, prosperity and long life to the convent fathers of Palestine. So, rested and refreshed, we fell into line and filed away over the barren mountains of Judea, and along rocky ridges, and through sterile gorges, where eternal silence and solitude reigned. Even the scattering groups of armed shepherds we met the afternoon before, tending their flocks of long-haired goats, were wanting here. We saw but two living creatures. They were gazelles, of oft-eyed notoriety. They looked like very young kids, but they annihilated distance like an express train. I have not seen animals that moved faster, unless I might say it of the antelopes of our own great plains. At 9 or 10 in the morning we reached the plain of the shepherds, and stood in a walled garden of olives, where the shepherds were watching their flocks by night, 18 centuries ago, when the multitude of angels brought them the tidings that the Savior was born. A quarter of a mile away was Bethlehem of Judea, and the pilgrims took some of the stone wall and hurried on. The plain of the shepherds is a desert, paved with loose stones, void of vegetation, glaring in the fierce sun. Only the music of the angels it knew once could charm its shrubs and flowers to life again, and restore its vanished beauty. No less potent enchantment could avail to work this miracle. In the huge Church of the Nativity, in Bethlehem, built 1500 years ago by the inveterate Saint Helena, they took us below ground, and into a grotto cut in the living rock. This was the angle where Christ was born. A silver star set in the floor bears a Latin inscription to that effect. It is polished with the kisses of many generations of worshipping pilgrims. The grotto was tricked out in the usual tasteless style observable in all the holy places of Palestine. As in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, envy and uncharitableness were apparent here. The priests and the members of the Greek and Latin churches cannot come by the same corridor to kneel in the sacred birthplace of the Redeemer, but are compelled to approach and retire by different avenues, lest they quarrel and fight on this holiest ground on earth. I have no hesitations, suggested by this spot, where the very first Merry Christmas was uttered in all the world, and from whence the friend of my childhood, Santa Claus, departed on his first journey, to gladden and continue to gladden roaring firesides on wintry mornings in many a distant land forever and forever. I touch, with reverent finger, the actual spot where the infant Jesus lay, but I think nothing. You cannot think in this place any more than you can in any other in Palestine, that would be likely to inspire reflection. Beggars, cripples and monks compass you about, and make you think only of bucksheesh, when you would rather think of something more in keeping with the character of the spot. I was glad to get away, and glad when we had walked through the grottos where Eusebius wrote, and Jerome fasted, and Joseph prepared for the flight into Egypt, and the dozen other distinguished grottos, and knew we were done. The Church of the Nativity is almost as well packed with exceeding holy places as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself. They even have in it a grotto wherein 20,000 children were slaughtered by Herod, when he was seeking the life of the infant Savior. We went to the milk grotto, of course a cavern, where Mary hid herself for a while before the flight into Egypt. Its walls were black before she entered, but in suckling the child, a drop of her milk fell upon the floor, and instantly changed the darkness of the walls to its own snowy hue. We took many little fragments of stone from here, because it is well known in all the East that a barren woman hath need only to touch her lips to one of these and her failing will depart from her. We took many specimens, to the end that we might confer happiness upon certain households that we wot of. We got away from Bethlehem and its troops of beggars and relic peddlers in the afternoon, and after spending some little time at Rachel's tomb, hurried to Jerusalem as fast as possible. I never was so glad to get home again before. I never have enjoyed rest as I have enjoyed it during these last few hours. The journey to the Dead Sea, the Jordan and Bethlehem was short, but it was an exhausting one. Such roasting heat, such oppressive solitude, and such dismal desolation cannot surely exist elsewhere on earth. And such fatigue. The commonest sagacity warns me that I ought to tell the customary pleasant lie and say I tore myself reluctantly away from every noted place in Palestine. Everybody tells that, but with as little ostentation as I may, I doubt the word of every he who tells it. I could take a dreadful oath that I have never heard any one of our 40 pilgrims say anything of the sort, and they are as worthy and as sincerely devout as any that come here. They will say it when they get home, fast enough, but why should they not? They do not wish to array themselves against all the Lamartins and Grimeses in the world. It does not stand to reason that men are reluctant to leave places where the very life is almost badgered out of them by importunate swarms of beggars and peddlers who hang in strings to one's sleeves and coattails, and shriek and shout in his ears, and horrify his vision with the ghastly sores and malformations they exhibit. One is glad to get away. I have heard shameless people say they were glad to get away from ladies' festivals, where they were importuned to buy by bevies of lovely young ladies. Transform those houris into dusky hacks and ragged savages, and replace their rounded forms with shrunken and knotted distortions, their soft hands with scarred and hideous deformities, and the persuasive music of their voices with the discordant din of a hated language, and then see how much lingering reluctance to leave could be mustered. No, it is the neat thing to say you were reluctant, and then append the profound thoughts that struggled for utterance in your brain. But it is the true thing to say you were not reluctant, and found it impossible to think at all, though in good sooth it is not respectable to say it, and not poetical either. We do not think in the holy places. We think in bed, afterwards, when the glare, and the noise, and the confusion are gone, and in fancy we revisit alone the solemn monuments of the past, and summon the phantom pageants of an age that has passed away. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.